Coming up on Star Stuff, the sun has hit solar max, but here on Earth it looks like things are still safe from being sizzled by superflares. More unsolved mysteries about the moon's mysterious magnetic field. And here's a question for you. Would antimatter fall down or up? All that and more coming up on Star Stuff.
This is Star Stuff.
Well, you can forget about all those claims of gloom and doom, Mayan calendars and apocalypse. According to most data, the sun has now hit solar max, the climax of its 11-year solar cycle. And you can rest easy. Earth should be safe from being sizzled by a superflare. Research reported in the pre-press physics blog archive.org has found these massive eruptions, a million times more powerful than solar flares on the sun, are usually restricted to young, fast-spinning stars. Lead author Yuta Natsu from Kyoto University, together with some colleagues, used NASA's Kepler Space Telescope to examine changes in brightness of stars known to produce superflares. They found these brightness variations could simply be explained by the rotation of the star displaying the superflare at different angles. The energy output of a superflare can be directly related to the size of the star spot generating them. Larger star spots contain more magnetic energy, which can then result in the production of larger flares. Like their solar flare counterparts produced by the sun, superflares occur above star spots, which, like sunspots, form when a star's magnetic field lines, twisted by the star's differential rotation, break through the surface, causing regions with cooler local temperatures appear as dark spots. The flares are produced as these magnetic field lines snap, flinging out electromagnetic radiation, protons, electrons, and heavier atomic nuclei. Natsu and colleagues examined 90,000 sun-like stars observed by Kepler, which is capable of seeing very subtle changes in stellar brightness. Of these, they picked up 365 superflare events on 148 stars. Only 9 of these events involved stars rotating slowly like the sun. But unlike the sun, even these stars had very large star spot regions. And this appears to be the key. You need big star spots to produce superflares. Mind you, there's still a question of just how big a solar flare from the sun can get. Dr. Matthew Francis, a space weather science officer with the Ionospheric Prediction Service, says we still don't have a good understanding of how solar flares work.
One of the things that we can learn by looking at other stars like our sun is sort of how we fit into the continuum. And we can study the sun all we like, but in a sense it's sort of only one data point. It's really interesting to see how other stars, you know, like our sun, behave, and we can sort of learn a more general relationship and find where we fit into that bigger picture. I think that's really interesting.
The concept of superflares, these things that can be a million times more powerful than the solar flares that our local star produces, do we know how they're produced, and are they produced in a different way to solar flares?
Well, our understanding of solar flares, I mean, one of the interesting things about this is that we still don't have as good an understanding of how solar flares work as we would like. The basic idea is that we have these sunspots, region on the sun or on stars, where you have this sort of higher level of magnetic activity. It's from those regions that occasionally we get this spontaneous rearrangement of all the magnetic fields, which releases a heap of energy, much of which is in the form of X-rays. And what we don't really know for our own sun is what's the biggest flares that we could possibly have, which is an important question for sort of learning, what's the biggest effects we need to know how to cope with on Earth. It's the magnetic field lines coming up through the surface of the sun, which gives you sort of little hole in the corona of the sun, which is why you have this sort of darker, slightly cooler region, which is the sunspot. The root cause of it is those magnetic fields, and the stronger the magnetic fields are, the bigger your flare. And what we find with spots on our sun is that the larger the sunspot, the stronger the magnetic fields. And this seems to be what this paper is showing as well on other stars, that where you have these larger spots on the star, you tend to get more of these, super flares.
these stars are younger and they're rotating faster?
Yeah, so it seems to be that the stars that rotate more quickly have stronger magnetic fields, which makes sense because the magnetic fields are actually generated by the spinning or the differential sort of rotation of the stars. If you have a rapidly spinning star, it's going to have strong magnetic fields. And what they're finding by viewing the Kepler data is that, yeah, they seem to have these larger star spots and therefore giving you these massive flares.
But there were 9 cases of flares coming from older stars too, weren't there?
Yeah, which is interesting. And I think the key difference that they're pointing out is that even though those stars were sort of older like our sun and had a similar surface temperature and a similar size, they did seem to have much larger star spots than we would see on our sun. A higher magnetic field. So I guess the relationship between the spin and the magnetic field isn't straightforward. The simple explanation always is, but the details is always murkier. So for whatever reason, these stars have a much stronger magnetic field, hence the bigger spots and these super flares, which fortunately don't seem to happen on our own sun.
Are there any implications for this work in terms of understanding our own sun better?
One of the things that we don't know and we'd really like to know in terms of understanding our sun from a sort of a space weather perspective is, how bad can it get? There's a sort of this 11-year solar cycle, which is quite long when you think about, modern sort of space era. We haven't measured enough of the sun with, modern instruments to answer that question. How bad can things get so that when we're engineering satellites or systems on the ground to be able to withstand the worst possible space weather events, we don't know what that upper limit is. So this kind of research is really good because, as I say, if we can fit ourselves into a continuum, if we can see, okay, stars that are a bit bigger or a bit faster, have this upper limit, if there's some general relationship, we might be able to learn more about, how bad things could be on our sun, which at the moment we sort of, it's only as bad as it's ever been is sort of the limit we've got. But, we've only been looking for a short amount of time.
What's the take-home message?
Well, I think the take-home message is that it really shows that while astronomy is, very interesting in itself, it could potentially be criticised as being not very practical. But, here's an example of where, astronomy, just a curiosity about what these stars at the other side of the galaxy are doing, is actually something that could really, impact on, how well your GPS works by knowing, what standards we need to engineer those systems.
Oh, it's worse than that. It's how well your radio works. That's my bread and butter.
Absolutely. Well, even your power supply, even the whole integrity of our power network, relies on being able to be engineered to a certain standard to withstand how bad things can get. So, this just shows another example of where sort of just, blue sky science, just sort of curiosity-driven science can have these unexpected, very useful consequences.
We're coming up towards solar max. Do we know how far away from it we are yet? I mean, I know there's no exact date these things happen. You just know it's happened when the poles flip on the sun. But what are the latest estimates?
I mean, the latest estimates are pretty much that, as you say, solar max doesn't happen on a certain, day. But the latest estimates are basically that in terms of the number of sunspots, we're basically at solar max pretty much nowish. And the final, you really only know about sort of 12 months after it actually happened where it was. But in the end, it will probably be about now or a few months ago or maybe in a few months' time. So we're pretty much at that limit.
It's an unusually mild solar cycle, isn't it?
Yeah. There's quite a difference. The two hemispheres of the sun are actually behaving quite differently in the solar cycle. So there's actually a kind of a double peak happening. So one of those hemispheres has sort of clearly already peaked and is now declining, and the other one is sort of maybe about to do that. So when you sort of average those two out, it's sort of the net peak is sort of, as I say, about now. But the interesting thing is that the majority of the activity actually tends to happen on what we call the declining phase.
Yes, right.
So it's actually not the maximum that's the worst in terms of the space weather events. It actually typically happens in the couple of years after that. So in terms of the actual activity...
That's in terms of CMEs and things like that you're talking about, I take it.
Exactly, yeah. CMEs and the aurora events and things like that follow. It probably the peak of that will be over the next couple of years. But as I say, compared to recent solar maxes, it's very mild.
Do we understand why there's that differentiation between the hemispheres in terms of sunspot activity?
It does seem to be something that is seen in a lot of the solar cycles. It comes down to we sort of do on a big picture level we understand about how the you know, the core of the sun is rotating and how that causes the magnetic fields and so on. But the details, we don't understand.
That's Dr. Matthew Francis, a space weather science officer with the Ionospheric Prediction Service. Physicists have announced a breakthrough in their quest to answer one of science's great questions. Namely, do the same laws of gravity, which apply to matter, also apply to antimatter, the obscure counterpart of matter? Or to put it more simply, would antimatter fall up or down? Though antimatter is thought to have existed in equal amounts to matter at the moment of the Big Bang some 13.8 billion years ago, it's rarely seen today. When matter and antimatter meet, they annihilate each other, giving off a flash of light. Theoretically, with equal amounts created during the Big Bang, they all should have annihilated each other, meaning the universe should be empty. Clearly it's not. These days, antimatter particles are thought to exist mainly around black holes and in cosmic rays. While antimatter may sound terribly rare and exotic, most of us have already had close encounters with antimatter. For instance, some of the potassium in bananas will emit positrons, the antimatter counterpart to an electron. It's a normal process of banana decay. Sodium also emits positrons, and if these are combined with antiprotons, the antimatter counterpart of the proton, which can be created in a particle accelerator and then slowed down in a proton decelerator, scientists can create antihydrogen atoms. And at CERN, the European Organisation for Nuclear Research, they've managed to do just that, trapping 309 antihydrogen atoms for up to 1,000 seconds, or just over 16 minutes. For more than 50 years, scientists have been debating whether gravity would attract or repel antimatter particles, whether they'd fall down like conventional matter or fall up due to some kind of anti-gravity. While this question remains unresolved for now, scientists with CERN's Alpha experiment have developed the beginnings of a test which should lead to a conclusive answer. Reporting in the journal Nature, they've taken their first steps towards a direct experimental test of questions physicists and non-physicists have been wondering about for more than 50 years. Does antimatter fall up or down? Antimatter particles have opposite properties to ordinary matter particles, including their electrical charge. As we mentioned earlier, when matter meets antimatter, they annihilate each other, giving off a flash of energy, which means that if an even balance had continued to persist after the Big Bang, the universe would never have come into being. How our universe became a matter universe rather than an antimatter universe or a zilch is one of the great riddles of particle physics. Scientists also scratch their heads over whether antimatter would respond in the same way as matter to gravity, or whether it would move in a different direction and a different speed. Some believe the fact the universe is comprised almost entirely of matter could be explained if antimatter did indeed fall up. But others assume it would have to behave exactly the same as matter in relation to gravity. The problem is, no proof exists for either theory. Still, most scientists expect antimatter to fall down. But in the unlikely event that antimatter does fall upwards, physicists will need to fundamentally revise their view of physics and rethink how the universe works. The Alpha team's experiment worked on manufacturing and trapping antihydrogen atoms, the antimatter counterpart of the simplest atom hydrogen. The atoms were placed in a magnetic trap, which was then switched off, allowing them to fall and hit the trap walls in a flash of energy. Researchers realized that by analyzing how and where the atoms hit, and with what sort of velocity, they could determine if gravity acted on antihydrogen differently to what it would on regular hydrogen. If antimatter acted the same as regular matter, the rate of its gravitational mass to its inertial mass would be the same. Gravitational mass is determined by a body's response to gravity, while inertial mass measures its resistance to acceleration. From its early measurements, the Alpha team were able to place outer limits on the ratio of plus 110 on the one side and minus 65 on the other, a margin that will need to be refined with more accurate tools and methods. The experiment is now being upgraded, and more precise data should become available when it reopens next year. Professor Ray Volkas is a physicist at the University of Melbourne.
So antimatter is a form of matter that is required by quantum theory. And the idea is that almost all particles, ordinary particles like electrons and protons and neutrons, have particles of exactly the same mass, but the opposite properties in other things like electric charge. So for example, the antiparticle of an electron is a particle with the same mass as the electron, but it's positively charged rather than negatively charged.
How does that work with a neutron?
So the neutron doesn't have electric charge, but it has other properties that are opposite. So it carries something called baryon number, which in some respects is like an electric charge. In other respects, it's different. And an antineutron has opposite baryon number.
There's more to it than just the charge itself.
It's not just the electric charge. I mean, there are other quantities in particle physics that behave in a similar way to electric charge. Baryon number is one of them. There's another thing called lepton number, which is also behaves in some ways like electric charge. They're not exactly the same, but there are aspects of their behavior that are similar. Now, there are also particles that are their own antiparticles. So the photon is like that. The photon is the elementary particle of light, and it is the same as its antiparticle. Most particles have distinct antiparticles, but some of them, like photons, happen to be their own antiparticle.
Would antimatter fall up or down in the presence of gravity? Interesting question. I would have thought gravity is primarily dictated by mass, the effect of mass on space-time.
Well, the point here is to test an expectation experimentally. You know, physics obviously has a lot of theory in it, but it also, it's very important to test what we think we believe theoretically in the real world and see if our expectations are correct. So, you know, the theory of how particles behave in gravitational fields tells us very clearly that particles and antiparticles should behave exactly the same. So if an apple falls to the ground, then an anti-apple should also fall to the ground, you know? The problem is that there's very little antimatter in the universe today. All the stars and galaxies and planets and asteroids and comets and everything are made of matter, not antimatter. So it's very difficult for us to actually experimentally determine the properties of antimatter and just check that the standard theory is correct. But it's very important to do that because, you know, it's always possible that our understanding is wrong. And if an experiment was able to prove that the gravitational properties of antimatter were different from those of matter, then that changes everything. You know, that would be a really, really dramatic discovery, which would overturn a lot of the theoretical structures that we use to understand elementary particles. So, you know, just to create antihydrogen was a big deal. And now what they want to do is trap some of it and then release the trap and just watch the antihydrogen move in the gravitational field. And they want to know, does it go down or does it go up? If it goes down, at what acceleration does it go down? Does it go down in exactly the same way as a hydrogen atom would? And so that's essentially the experiment they're doing. And at the moment, they can't even tell if the antihydrogen is going up or going down. But I think the breakthrough is just that now this type of experiment is feasible. They have some limit on the behavior of antihydrogen in gravity. And in the future, they hope to improve the experiment and determine the gravitational behavior of antimatter more and more precisely. And that's quite interesting.
That's Professor Ray Valkas, a physicist with the University of Melbourne. Scientists have heard the first pops of an experiment that searches for signs of dark matter in the form of tiny bubbles. But researchers at the United States Department of Energy's Fermi National Accelerator Laboratory will need to carry out further analysis in order to discern if it really was dark matter that caused the CUBE-60 experiment's first bubbles. The CUBE-60 dark matter experiment is located 2 kilometres underground. It uses a tank of purified water and CF3I, an ingredient found in fire extinguishers. The liquid in the detector is kept at a temperature and pressure slightly above boiling point, but it requires an extra bit of energy to actually form a bubble. When a passing particle enters the detector and disturbs an atom in the clear liquid, it provides that additional energy. And voila! A bubble appears. Dark matter particles, which scientists think rarely interact with other matter, should form individual bubbles in the CUBE-60 tank. These events would be so rare, scientists really only expect to detect one or two a year. Other, more common and interactive particles, such as neutrons, are more likely to leave a trail of multiple bubbles as they pass through the detector. Still, over the next few months, scientists will be analysing the bubbles that form in their detector to see how well COOP60 is working and to determine whether they're actually seeing signs of dark matter. The COOP60 detector is the latest addition to a suite of dark matter experiments running at Snow Labs Underground Science Laboratory, located deep under Ontario, Canada. Scientists run dark matter experiments underground in order to shield them from the distracting background of other particles which are constantly showering the Earth from space. Dark matter particles don't have a problem moving through the 2 kilometres of rock under which the laboratory is buried. Astronomers first proposed the existence of dark matter when they noticed that visible matter couldn't account for the total mass needed to generate the gravity needed to stop galaxies flying apart through centrifugal force as they rotated. Some invisible mass, which we now call dark matter, must have been there, providing the additional mass and hence gravity needed to hold things together. A new study of Apollo 11 lunar rocks has revealed that the moon's magnetic field lasted some 160 million years longer than previously thought. The discovery report in the Journal of the Proceedings of the National Academy of Sciences provides a new insight into the moon's ancient geology and evolution, showing it was continuously active well after the final large basin-forming impacts. Scientists, including lead author Clement Servet from the Massachusetts Institute of Technology, reached their conclusions after re-examining two 3.56 billion-year-old Mare basalts collected during that historic first manned mission to the lunar surface in July 1969. The rock samples, numbered 10017 and 10049, were originally collected by Neil Armstrong and Buzz Aldrin from the floor of the Sea of Tranquility. They're believed to have been ejecta thrown up from the West Crater impact site, located about half a kilometre from the lunar module's landing spot. The scientists subjected the samples to thermal cooling tests and alternating frequency demagnetisation in order to precisely determine their properties. They concluded that both samples had been magnetised in a stable and surprisingly intense magnetic field of at least 13 microtesla. The results appear to exclude impact-driven changes in the moon's rotation as a source for the dynamo during this time in lunar history. They say the data instead suggests a persistent power source such as precession of the lunar mantle or maybe a compositional convection dynamo. A global magnetic field is generated by a moving liquid core called a dynamo. While the Moon lacks a planetary-wide magnetic field today, lunar crustal magnetism and paleomagnetism found in rock samples indicate it still had a core dynamo 4.2 billion years ago. Some models for lunar core thermal convection show a lunar dynamo could still have been operating as recently as 4.1 billion years ago. Today, however, seismic data indicates the Moon only has a partially molten metallic core, which is incapable of driving a dynamo effect. Still, previous samples indicate an active magnetic field was still present as recently as 3.7 billion years ago. And these latest tests provide an even younger 3.56 billion-year-old date for these samples, making existing theories on the origins of lunar magnetism difficult to explain. A compositional convection dynamo would be generated by the movement of molten rocks as different minerals crystallize at different temperatures and pressures during core cooling. The problem is the lifetime for such a process is unclear, and that's led to alternative theories such as tidal heating, which would cause melting due to changes in the moon's rotation because of, say, asteroid impact events, or through precession, which involves slight wobbles in the moon's spin. Large impacts do have the potential to unlock the moon from synchronous rotation with Earth. That would cause differential motion between the moon's mantle and its core, and that could generate a dynamo. But the problem with this idea is that a subsequent search has failed to find any craters of the right age, which could have been caused by asteroids large enough to actually affect the rotation of an entire body such as the Moon. So, with impact rotation ruled out, and mystery still surrounding exactly when the lunar core dynamo finally decayed, that leaves us with either precession or thermochemical convection. Dr. Simon O'Toole from the Australian Astronomical Observatory says the work's important in narrowing down the options.
And I think it's an important study because it's always good if you've got a series of different models to try and explain a phenomenon, it's always good to be able to rule some of them out. So that's, to me, that's the key thing is, the key thing here is that they've ruled out the impact-driven changes in the rotation rate as a cause, as a source of the dynamo. So basically, all of the big, the large impacts, so there are impacts going on the moon all the time, but the large impacts ceased about 3.7 billion years ago, give or take a small amount. And so what they're saying, they've said that lunar dynamo actually existed longer than that, more into more recent times. So therefore, that excludes this impact-driven change as a source of the dynamo. And that's a key sort of thing. So basically, we're narrowing down the possibilities to something like precession in the lunar mantle. So that's sort of the wobbling of the moon's rotation axis. Because we still see a bit of precession, that's still going on. So why would the dynamo have stopped? Because we know that there is no dynamo really now. There's magnetism on the surface of the moon, I think, but not deeper into the core. That leaves a compositional convection dynamo. So where you have the different metals, the different elements in the core of the moon crystallizing at different times, and therefore you get this sort of like a stratification, and you get a dynamo based on the varying densities of the lunar core. So it's a systematic ruling out of the various models that exist, and that's really what science is all about. One of the other key results is that they've extended the known lifetime of the lunar dynamo a little bit. So that also has an impact on what model you can realistically expect to match the data. So, I mean, that's part of including this impact-driven changes, I suppose. Science is all about trying to predict or explain physical phenomena, and then you come up with a series of models, and then you try and, you know, rule out each one based on the evidence. And what they've done here is they've accrued more evidence that suggests that a pretty major model, the impact-driven changes in the rotation rate of the core, has been ruled out. And that's a pretty big thing, really.
That's Dr. Simon O'Toole, planetary scientist with the Australian Astronomical Observatory. Australia is about to experience an eclipse of the Sun. This one won't be a total eclipse when the Moon passes between the Earth and Sun completely blocks out the Sun, but an annular eclipse where a ring of the Sun remains around the Moon's silhouette. It'll sweep across the Australian outback and into the Pacific Ocean on Friday morning, May the 10th local time. Though about 95% of the lunar disk will be covered, the remaining 5% of Sun will be so bright that the darkening of the sky will hardly be noticeable. The annular phase will start at sunrise in far northwestern Western Australia. The 300-kilometre-wide path will include Tennant Creek, about 500 kilometres north of Alice Springs in the Northern Territory, where it will last for about 3 minutes, and about 4.5 minutes at the centre line, about 50 kilometres north of Tennant Creek. The path of annularity will then cross the Gulf of Carpentaria in Cape York, with about 4.75 minutes of annularity before leaving the Australian mainland behind. While traversing the Pacific, the path of annularity will include New Guinea and the northwestern Solomon Islands. The peak duration of the eclipse will be slightly east of the Tarawa Islands, with about 6 minutes of annularity. Weather permitting, everyone in Australia except the western third of WA should be able to see a partial eclipse. The Sun's diameter will be about 36% covered in Melbourne at about 8:50 a.m. local time, 38% covered in Canberra, 39% in Sydney at about 8:55 a.m. local time, and 52% covered in Brisbane. Partial phases will also be visible in the southern Philippines, in eastern Indonesia, and in the northeastern part of New Zealand's South Island and all of its North Island, though only about 8% coverage in Auckland. Also in the zone of partial phases are the entire Hawaiian Islands, with something like 44% of solar diameter covered in Honolulu. The northeastern limit of the partial eclipse will occur just off the west coast of Baja California. The next total eclipse of the Sun will be across mid-northern Africa on November the 3rd. And for more details, just go to the ABC Science website. And that's the show for now. If you've missed part of it on the radio or you want to hear the show again, don't forget Star Stuff's available as a weekly podcast at abc.net.au/science/Star Stuff. The Star Stuff blog's always packed full of the latest news, spectacular images, stuff I find amusing, and heaps of other media we simply couldn't fit in the show. You can find it all at abcstarstuff.tumblr.com. That's all one word and in lowercase. And that's Tumblr without the E. And there's our ABC Star Stuff Twitter feed for the latest developments in astronomy, space sciences and cosmology as they happen. We give you current news, information, ongoing updates and cool URLs. Just Google in the at symbol, followed by ABC Star Stuff, all as one word in lowercase, and we'll keep you informed. And for the latest news in science and technology, go to the ABC Science website at abc.net.au/science.